Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Kavit Takhwe. The Eurozone and the Euro, it's more about its survival than its economic and financial success. The usual countries are in the spotlight, for example, Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and France, to name a few. Well, in this debate, we're going to look at why, over 3 years into the Eurozone crisis, the situation remains unresolved and growth weak, threatening the very fabric of societies as evident in mass protests. We're also going to take a look at Germany, the powerhouse. Are things as rosy there as people think?
The economic downturn in the Eurozone is taking a new toll on jobs and output. The situation in Greece, Spain, and Portugal is more critical as their economies struggle to cope with a worsening debt crisis. The funding costs at Portugal's treasury bill auction has risen to a 12-month high, indicating the country's political limbo is taking a toll on the economy. The interest rate for one-year bonds rose to 1.72% from a previous 1.23%. Investor confidence has fallen since the Portuguese president called on parties signed up to the rescue program to reach an agreement on radical reforms to save the economy. Latest reports from Germany also indicate that investor confidence unexpectedly dropped this month over negative data in the bloc. Meanwhile, Spain, the Eurozone's fourth largest economy, is also struggling with an ailing debt crisis. The country's public debt has more than doubled since a global crisis hit the country in 2008. Forecasts show that the situation is expected to further deteriorate, with public debt reaching 91.4% of the GDP by the end of the year. Greece, which is the hardest hit country in the Eurozone, is also heading for more austerity. The new measures have raised anger among public sector workers, who will be the hardest hit. Athens plans to slash more than 12,000 public sector jobs under pressure from the troika of international lenders to be eligible for more bailout loans.
The only things that you talk about are prices and productivity and competitiveness, but you don't discuss criteria where the poverty line lies or where the level of basic human subsistence should be.
It's a critical day for us. We are expecting lawmakers to rise to the occasion and for them to not shut down the municipal police force. We will continue our struggle, regardless of what happens today. Of course, if the outcome pleases us, we have no reason to continue. If it does not please us, we will continue our fight.
Latest reports coming from Italy also show that the Eurozone's third largest economy could be facing a humanitarian crisis as recession lingers. About 5 million people across the country are living in absolute poverty, with families in southern regions hit the hardest. The latest outlook by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, also suggests that the social scars of the debt crisis in Europe are far from over. The organization has warned that the unemployment rate across many EU countries will remain stubbornly high over the next year, with little chances of much recovery. The younger generation will continue to face record unemployment levels. The OECD has called on governments to take proper measures, including structural reforms to boost growth and create more jobs, to tackle the spiraling crisis. But many experts believe that the improper measures adopted to contain the crisis have already done their damage and prolonged the prospects for recovery.
Let's find out how bad or how good things are in the Eurozone. Let me introduce our guest from MarketTicker.org. Carl Denninger joins us from Florida. And we have senior analyst from Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who joins us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome. Carl Denninger. I'm going to reflect on what the European Parliament President Martin Schulz has said recently in an interview. And when asked about how he would rate the EU officials and how they have handled the Eurozone crisis, he said that he would give them 3 out of 10. How would you rate them?
Oh, I'd rate him as a zero because nobody wants to deal with where the root of the problem came from, and they don't want to force those people who borrowed too much money and those who lent too much money, which to a large degree are banks that have government backstops of various forms, to take their medicine. The problem with the European zone in general is that when the EU came together, it essentially set up a welfare transfer payment system from Germany and to some extent France into the interior and into the southern states, such as Greece. And this is all fine and well as long as you are continuing to expand credit on an ever grander and grander scale. But eventually you get to the point that people can't pay. And when that happens, somebody has to eat their medicine. The problem with what we have going on in Europe, and it's spreading into other parts of the world, is that nobody throughout the crisis in 2007, 2008, and up until today has been willing to face this. So you have calls for austerity in Greece, which is all fine and well. Greece has to stop spending money that they can't earn. But at the same time, who is supposed to eat the loss that was occasioned by lending them money they can't pay back? The idea that this is somehow all banks and not by the Deutsche Banks of the world is outrageous. And yet that's what's been going on. And so we will not continue. We're not going to see a solution to this until we actually address what happened.
Well, let's look at, for example, I'm going to focus on Germany by making a referral to this gentleman, Peter Bofinger. He's an economist from the German Council of Economic Experts. He says the data shows that the worst of the euro crisis is not yet over. He made the statement roughly around March. And he said that we are in the middle of the crisis, and even worse, the crisis is spreading from the weak peripherals to the core. If you could explain that to us, and again, this was made this year in March, I would think that the worst would have been over. But it doesn't seem like that's the case based on what this Peter Bofinger has said.
No, it's not over because you didn't take care of the structural problem that caused it in the first place. All you did was apply Band-Aids to it by lowering the cost of credit. So you take somebody who is too much in debt, let's take an analog, someone that drinks too much alcohol, and your solution to them being a drunk all the time is you give them a cheap case of whiskey. This doesn't solve anything. All it does is allow them to continue to be a drunk for a little while longer. The only way you're going to fix the problem is to get people out of the idea that they can borrow money to consume things. You can't. You can only legitimately, in a balanced economy, borrow money to expand production. But we have built a society over the last 30 years on a global basis in the developed world that thinks that you can borrow money to buy stuff that you're then going to consume and end up with nothing. That's insane, but that's what we're doing.
Well, there's criticism leveled against Angela Merkel, and basically that her government and the message they send is just austerity. Is that to blame right now as it being counterproductive to stimulate growth and to create jobs, or on the wide spectrum for it to have a positive effect, that's not the way to go?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the real question is, as long as you have an excessive debt load in the system, then there are servicing costs to that debt load because you have to pay the principal and the interest, or at least the interest, if not the principal. So you cannot have economic progress until I can fund expansion from surplus. So whatever I put into the economy, whatever I produce, I take what I have to spend in order to sustain my life, and what's left is surplus. If there is no surplus because I'm giving it all to some banker who loaned me money and he's unwilling to take a loss, the government is protecting him from me turning around and saying, guess what, I can't pay you, I'm bankrupt, have a nice day. Then what you have is an economy that is stifled and can't recover because the debt that is embedded within there is too high. And if the servicing cost does not come down, and you can't just do it by decreasing interest rates forever, then what happens is you get no economic growth. We've seen that throughout Germany. It's showing up in the German numbers now. We've seen it throughout the Eurozone. And it's showing up in the United States, where we're now putting up sub 2% GDP numbers. We should be, if we weren't debt saturated, seeing numbers in the 5 to 6% area. But we're not. And the reason is the same here as it is there.
Well, let's bring Ian Williams into the picture here. Ian Williams, I'm looking at a typical month for the Eurozone. What do you have? These Greek labor unions right now, massive protests outside parliament on a vote taking place there that's going to entail most likely anywhere from 12 to up to 30,000 job cuts towards that's going to happen towards the end of the year. Not to mention what? France downgraded from a AAA to AA. Even the bloc's first rescue fund, the European Financial Stability Facility, they were even downgraded by Fitch. Portugal's high-profile resignations, the foreign minister and the finance ministers. And that's just a typical month, it appears, to be in the Eurozone. What do we look, when you look at the Eurozone after all these years, where do you see it going? What's your take on the whole situation regarding the crisis that it's finding itself in?
Well, it's like most of the modern economy, it's running on illusions. The whole idea that anybody is ever going to pay back all of these debts is completely illusionary. The fact that British banks are worth two or three times as much as Britain, that Iceland had those huge overhangs, we've almost completely lost touch with the idea that an economy is actually people making and selling goods and services to each other. And this sort of cotton candy money that they've been spinning up and then lending is fundamentally going to always come to a crisis. In the case of Europe, the debts that they have run up are not that horrific, frankly, but it's all about confidence. And confidence is a magic word. The fact that the rating agencies, which as many people on your shows over the years have pointed out, are themselves deeply flawed, is the fact that we're relying upon their judgment about Greece and Portugal is almost laughable. The fact that people want to buy Portuguese and Greek debt because it pays higher interest rates than, say, U.S. Treasuries is sort of interesting. But that increased interest is supposed to repay them for the risk. But there is no risk because the predominant neoliberal idea seems to be that despite all of the moral hazards of debt, they actually, bankers never pay the bills. Customers have to pay the bills, like in the United States, where students have to pay loans even if they go bankrupt. Where there's no relief on a mortgage if a family goes bankrupt, but the banks can just walk away. And the shareholders and the bondholders tend to get paid before the actual people out there who borrow the money. And on top of all this, the banks aren't lending money. The system is fundamentally flawed, and nobody's actually sitting down to think of a root and branch way. You know, we don't have to be a Marxist, but if we need a John Maynard Keynes who can actually come and say, well, this is one way to get things kick-started again.
Well, this is very confusing, Carl Deniger, and that's about the money that these banks are given. And I, you know, we hear about the interest rates being very low and, of course, 0% interest rates, but not negative deposit rates, which some have called the ECB's or the European Central Bank's best weapon. What's the rationale behind that?
Well, there isn't one. What they're trying to do is increase the velocity of money by making it uneconomic to stick it in the bank. In other words, you got to spend it because otherwise you're going to have to essentially pay a tax to hang on to it. The problem is that the bank can't actually do that because they can say, well, you have a negative deposit rate. And then I say, well, give me all my euros. I'm going to go put it in my safe in my house or under my mattress. And, you know, you can go stick it because I don't have to follow this regime of yours. So the idea that you can actually charge negative deposit rates and get away with it for any length of time is laughable. But what at the end of the day, what we have going on here is banks that have created all of this credit money. And it's not just the central banks. It's not even predominantly the central banks. It's the commercial side of this equation. They created all of this credit backed by absolutely nothing. And then they turned around and wrote derivatives based on this and said, well, you know, this derivative says that if this person doesn't pay, you have to cover it so there's no risk. The problem is nobody ever polices the person who's on the other side of that transaction to make sure that they have the cash. And the fact of the matter is that they don't. So we have this entire house of cards that's built upon a bunch of false premises, and none of the governments involved will sit down and tell these banks that they have to cut this out, because if they do, then the government cannot run a deficit anymore. If you can't peddle your treasury debt to those banks because the bank's out of business, you can't run a budget deficit. You now have to actually raise the money that you want to spend through taxes. And that's anathema to everybody, whether it be the Germans, whether it be the Italians, the Greeks, or anybody else. And so as a result, we have this conundrum. You have essentially the banks that have put a gun to the head of the government and said, if you do this, we fail. And the government said, oh, well, then we won't do that. But the only way to solve the problem is to take this leverage back out of the system. And that means that the people who loan the money are going to fail because they aren't going to get paid back. And at the end of the day, until that happens, we're not going to see a solution to this.
Well, I'd like to break down this what's called the quantitative easing, Ian Williams, not to get too much in the technicality behind it, but we're going to get into it a little bit. I mean, since this crisis started, you have the Bank of England and also the Federal Reserve that has pumped money into its economy. We're looking at, for example, the quantitative easing of the United States, $40 billion a month for 2012, $80 billion for 2013, set to go through the year.
This is supposed to create some kind of financial health, economic health, but it's not doing that. I mean, based on some accounts, $40 billion a month, for example, would amount to 9,600,000 jobs paying $50,000 a year. But it's not doing that. Where is this money going? Are the banks holding on to it? Which then, of course, arises the question, why aren't they lending it out?
Well, no, we have it's a much simpler than that.
Ian Williams, go ahead.
That it is now an established dogma that you can't allow governments to spend. So the governments are printing this money, giving it to the banks, and hoping that the banks will put it into productive loans and uses. The sort of full Keynesian approach, which I tend to approve, would be the government itself would spend that money. It wouldn't give it to the banks. It would invest in public works. It would invest in bridges and roads and schools. It would invest in hospitals. It would invest in infrastructure. It would even hire people. If you remember, Keynes' famous phrase was bury the dollar bills and pay people to dig them up. That actually gets money into it. But what's happening is the money is being lent to banks who then use it to play with financial instruments of one kind or another and try to make money out of the arbitrage on the interest rates. They're getting money for next to nothing. They're then lending it to some consumers at exorbitant interest rates. And the government, under the shibboleth of not interfering with private enterprise, isn't taking it. So even though the government's almost owned the banks and rescued them, they're too scared to actually tell the banks what to do. And as your previous speaker said, the banks think that they've got the government as a hostage and the government thinks they're a hostage. In fact, of course, they could turn around and say, hey, we're taking you over. You don't have enough liquidity. We are going to run you from now on and we will make you spend. But that would go against every shibboleth of neoliberalism, that the government running banks, the government can pay for banks, the government can finance banks, it can lend them banks their money indefinitely, but it can't run them. It's the law.
Well, let's take a quick time out and listen to one viewer comment on the subject as posted on our Facebook page.
Just as the Federal Reserve banking elite are purposely wrecking, crashing, destroying America, so is its sister group in Europe called the ECB. They are the same clique of bankers with the same agenda. Send the masses into poverty.
The name of this viewer is Alex Salentis. I have a feeling maybe Greek, I don't know. But Carl Denninger, you heard our guest there. I mean, that can't be the case, can it? Put it simply, as this viewer has said, with the Federal Reserve and its sister group, as he called it, the ECB, sending the masses into poverty. But yet that's what we're seeing as an effect of some of these policies and activities that have taken place.
I don't know that it's their intention, but it's what they're doing. When you look at what the Federal Reserve is doing, the current quantitative easing program puts about 6% of the output of the economy into the economy as new credit-created money every year. So what this means is that unless the output of the economy expands by 6%, then the common person sees a net reduction in their standard of living. So since the economy in the United States is expanding at about 2%, the average American is essentially getting a 4% reduction in their standard of living every year as a direct result of this policy. And the problem with it is that there isn't any way to generate jobs and generate economic progress when my ability to actually go out in the marketplace and buy things is going down. My ability to buy things has to go up in order to generate economic progress as an average person. But that's not what's going on. I don't know that this is their intent, but this is the effect that they're having. And you're seeing the same thing over in Europe. You're seeing the same thing over in England. And until we actually face what mathematically has happened here and deal with this from a standpoint of basic arithmetic, we're never going to see a solution, because believing in something doesn't make it so.
And in the meantime, Ian Williams, you have countries like Greece that are through austerity. It seems like that's the only thing that's ruling it, through obviously coming from the command center of Germany, through the troika of lenders that is axing jobs. It's pretty much breaking up the fabric of society. I mean, just to take an example, Egypt, that country is paralyzed right now. People power on the streets there. And Greece has been on that verge, and we're seeing protests happen on a wide scale also across Europe. How much of a threat is that to the country in terms of the money being lent out, but yet having democracy be destroyed in the process with people out on the streets protesting?
Well, it's an enormous problem, but until you actually face what you've done over the last 30 years, you're never going to solve this. If you look at the United States as an example, from 1980 until the crash in 2008, we did not have one three-month period where the economy expanded faster than the amount of debt that went into the economy expanded. So what that means is that in terms of actual output, we didn't have one three-month period where we did anything other than build more leverage. We didn't actually expand anything. And yet this is the model that you have the central bankers and the governments and the commercial bankers continue to try to run. We got around this for a period of time by offshoring our production to China and India and taking all of our good jobs and sending them overseas. But eventually you squeeze all the costs that you can out of the economy by doing that. And what do we end up with? We end up with a job base that doesn't have any jobs. We have a production base that's been eviscerated. We don't manufacture anything anymore. And now what do? The same thing's happening in Europe. This went on for years. We finance the Germans finance the Greek people buying Mercedes-Benz automobiles, but the Greeks never pay for the Mercedes-Benz automobiles. Well, at some point, somebody stands up and says, excuse me, I'm never going to get paid. I'm not lending you anymore. And that's what's happening now. So then you say, well, we'll just cut jobs. But look, if I take all the government people and fire them, then what are they going to buy their food with? What are they going to buy their cars with, their gasoline, their heating, their heating oil, all of the other things that they need, not to mention the things that they want, which is what drives economic progress. So you have to get back to the basics of this, which is that we built these instabilities into the systems. We built these excesses into the system. The people who benefited from those excesses, many of them being the bankers and being these other entities, they need to take their piece of the medicine. And yet the only part of the damage that's being allocated is all onto the people. So mm-hmm. You have the people in Greece that are seeing their standard of living destroyed, but the Deutsche Bank guys up in Germany, they think this is just fabulous. Their earnings are just fine.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Obviously, so much more to discuss. Unfortunately, we don't have the time. Thank you very much. That was from MarketTicker.org, Carl Denninger, talking to us from Florida. Also like to thank Senior Analyst of Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who spoke to us from New York. And thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. Any questions or comments, newsroom@presstv.ir is our email address. For Mikhail Vitafa and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.